My impression, though, is that that is a delineation tool as opposed to an identification tool. And the reason delineation is important with wetlands is that they have transitional character. And that the dominant question of what is a natural wetland still lies in the RMA definition. Is that your view?
Yes.
And so in your assessment, you've taken a ecosystem ecological based assessment rather than just saying, well, if there's a wet hydrophilic species of any type, buttercup, it meets the definition. Is that the guts of it?
Yes. And to take that a step further, I would say, that's where we come to that sort of improved pasture caveat and exclusion. And as you might be aware with your Wellington cases, there is some discussion around the likes of buttercup being a pasture species.
Yes.
But I've certainly taken the approach that it is, because it, well, for starters, is recognised, the likes of the New Zealand Plant Conservation Network, as a species affiliated with pasture and pastoral practices. And whether I understand there is some debate about its intentional spreading versus accidental spreading, but it's my understanding that it was brought into New Zealand for pastoral purposes.
But from a sensible point of view, surely the ecosystem value of buttercup as the sole indicator of wetland is somewhat difficult for me to comprehend. Would you agree as an ecologist that that's the typical training that ecologists have, that they look at the ecosystem as a composite?
Yeah, very much so. And that's where I tried to put in some of that context into my thinking as I work through that wetland delineation and identification process, is to my reading, and I'm not a planner or the likes, but my reading of the MPS is very much a presence-absence approach and takes quite a all-inclusive approach.
Yes.
So I very much agree that it is worthwhile, and as a ecology practitioner, we do have a duty to consider the ecological value, not just presence absence of
if you look at the Clarkson 2013, which actually comes from the North American literature, it seems to be that their provenance is about ecosystems.
Mm.
But the difficulty from an ecologist is delineation. In other words, how much are you going to circumscribe as falling within that to enable a functioning ecosystem to be preserved? That's the problem that the delineation tool is solving.
Yeah. And if I sort of understand you correctly, part of the wetland delineation protocols in Clarkson 2013 is to, and she, well, Clarkson acknowledges that there does have to be some level of scrutiny and context applied to the results, but it is to help hone in, not clearly define our wetland feature. The inclusion of, to use the buttercup example, is that has been identified as a facultative species, and so all plants are given sort of a wetland affiliated score based on their preference for soil moisture content, and buttercup sits within the sort of ambiguous mid-range. That essentially means it can tolerate wet soils, but it can equally so tolerate dry soils. It's quite a general species.
And doesn't Clarkson 2013 also acknowledge particular caution with highly modified environments.
Yes. Yep.
So it might be a case of missing the buttercups from the trees, sort of. Or the trees from the buttercups. Yeah. Okay. Sorry, I just thought we'd get onto that while we were there. That's all right.
Yeah.
Next topic.
So I thought I'd touch on fish passage, putting a ecological context on it, following Mr. Leahy's stormwater engineer approach yesterday.
Yeah.
The Section 42A report detailed concerns around the ability to provide fish passage through the culverts that are required under the hub. I am confident, and I believe this was supported by Mr. Leahy yesterday, that given the gradient and size of the necessary pipes, the fish species likely to require passage can be provided for. I also believe the project provides an opportunity to improve the fish passage potential through the area, which is currently impeded, for example, due to the seasonal drying out of the streams in places. If we go to the next one down, B, is it? Yeah. I did acknowledge, although I admit it might not be clear in the clutter of this figure, that areas that I understand based on landowner conversations annually dry out include upstream of the site, but also this area just downstream of the culvert under Railway Road. My understanding is that is based on summer flows being sufficiently low that the flows can't actually get over and therefore through the culvert, so you end up with a dry patch downstream. Acknowledging that the summer dry spell coincides with a common migratory period for the likes of galaxids and eels, bullies and eels, sorry. I'll move on to the proposed recommended council conditions.
Yeah.
On the whole, I largely agree with the matters raised in the Section 42A report and the Council's ecologist Ms. Quinn's technical evidence in terms of the need to undertake further ecological surveys and develop an ecological management plan. However, with respect to the recommended conditions included in the Section 42A recommended designation conditions, I'm of the opinion these are better addressed at the regional consent phase because Condition 103, page 49.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I believe that these matters can be reasonably expected to be carried out as part of the ecological impact assessment that will be developed as part of the regional consenting phase. And then moving on to conditions 104 to 108 that relate to the ecological management plan. These, I believe, can be reasonably expected as part of the regional consent conditions. For example, the objective of the plan proposed by the Council is to manage adverse effects of construction and operation of the freight hub on ecological and biodiversity values. The effects are not realised until the regional consents have been obtained. Because of this, I consider that these conditions are not needed at this stage, and Ms. Bell will be able to detail the planning considerations relevant to this. So overall, I consider the freight hub will not have a measurable adverse effect on the local and regional ecology. There are also no sensitive or high-value ecological features that I recommend be avoided. From an ecological perspective, the project does not run counter to the new MPS for freshwater management And in fact, I believe will offer opportunities to enhance the aquatic ecosystem values.
Thank you. Is that it? Conclude your oral presentation?
Yes. Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Garrett Walker, and thank you for responding to Ms. Quinn's addendum as well. That was really helpful to do that. And the plans have been very beneficial as well. Firstly, I'll just give Ms. Bell a heads up that we'll have questions in terms of the relevant jurisdiction in terms of maintaining Indigenous biodiversity. And certainly in respect of Mr. Garrett Walker's last comments about what's appropriate at regional council stage versus what we're dealing with at the TA stage and the split between terrestrial and aquatic biodiversity in particular. Having said that, what are the species of fish that may use this fish passage? I hate those two words together.
I acknowledge there have been limited surveys done in the area, as shown in the New Zealand Freshwater Fish Database. But based on my observations of the habitat present and the habitat upstream of the site, I think it's highly likely that eels may be present, predominantly short fin eels rather than the long fin eel. And the habitats within sight may also, acknowledging it's not a fish, but seems to be grouped in with fish, as the freshwater crayfish, the coda, might be present. I believe upstream does provide better fish habitat, and sort of like Mr. Leahy touched on yesterday, they are heavily modified streams, but as part of that, they are quite incised, and there are large patches that are fenced off upstream. So that sort of provides the shading benefits, and the disturbance or lack of disturbance benefits. That does provide habitat for the likes of, say, banded corkapoo, though they haven't to date necessarily been recorded in the vicinity, but there is that habitat provision upstream. Some bully species might also be present, although I would proffer that they'd be in quite low densities, not just within the NOR designation, but also upstream of the site. So in terms of fish passage, I believe it will predominantly be eels and galaxid species if they are present in the wider site that I'm unsure of at this stage.
One thing I've been quite interested in is this naturalized channel and what that means exactly, particularly from an ecologist's point of view.
Naturalized in the sense of trying to provide habitat, a range of habitat features, a range of hydraulic flow regimes that we can only ponder as to what might have been present pre the land clearance and conversion to farming, but provides a range of habitat opportunities for fish that are or could be in the catchment. So it's the idea that it's naturalized in the sense that it reflects a flow regime that is variable, mm-hmm. rather than the current straight and narrow slow run conditions that are there at the moment.
So it had things like riffles added
and
the like.
Pools, riffles, meanders, backwaters. And my understanding is that this will be subject to the detailed design phase, that there is the space to create meanders, to create backwaters, to create a bit of a floodplain that potentially we could put wetlands on. But yeah, so exploring and then providing a range of habitats.
Yeah. So it is a brand spanking new channel, though, isn't it, to replace?
That's the hope. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Details yet to come, but.
Yeah, and my understanding, a lot of that would come out at the regional council consenting.
Yes. Yep.
Stage as well. Going back to the big culvert and hearing from Mr. Leahy yesterday, and this is obviously in the aquatic ecology space as well, but I was interested to hear how he was describing how it would be constructed in terms of basically the culvert constructed and then the streams diverted into it. From my previous experience with large projects, quite often a temporary diversion is put in place before the culvert is put in, and then it's then re-diverted into the culvert. So are you going to be involved in that process in terms of what the best option is and the best approach is?
Yes, yep. And it would be my expectation that those details and determining that process and then enacting that process would include a freshwater ecologist specifically, yes.
The other area I'm interested in is particularly when you've been talking about the offsetting and mitigation of ecological values, if there is a loss on the site, is to some degree the reliance on the stormwater ponds and the wetlands that are going to be artificially constructed, obviously. My question in that regard is, how satisfactory are they from an ecologist point of view, particularly if they're treatment wetlands? Are there... Are there any aspects to a treatment wetland that might not necessarily be conducive for them to be considered to be mitigation?
From an ecology perspective, I would say no. And certainly in my experience, you often find a range of birds, a range of fish, a range of invertebrates, happily living in stormwater treatment ponds. So the idea that stormwater treatment ponds might not be or should not be considered an ecological feature in their own right, I think is a sort of anthropomorphized concern. It's a perception that we have imposed or assumed, but that isn't necessarily realized in the ecological world. Notwithstanding, I acknowledge there are cultural aspects to that and stuff that I can't talk to, but in terms of fish will happily live anywhere, birds will happily live anywhere if you give them just suitable base habitat. sort of taking that a step further in terms of acknowledging that there might be opportunities within the stormwater treatment network, I've been envisaging that they'd be created not necessarily within the stormwater ponds or wetlands, but in the surrounds, so they can be incorporated into sort of these wider, what did Mr. Lakey call them? Sticky outy bits. And can be sort of integrated and supported by the stormwater network, but not relying wholeheartedly on the pond being acknowledged as the ecological offset or mitigation.
That's all from me for now. Thank you.
Kia ora. Thanks, Mr. Garrett Walker, for your evidence. It's been really helpful. And for your response to the questions already, which have covered a lot of the questions that I had planned to ask you. I do have a few remaining ones, though. And I might start just by taking you to your figure three. And I note the southern tributary marked on that map is characterised as an ephemeral stream. And I also note that you weren't able to access that stream in your latest site visit. And I just wondered if you could explain a little bit further how you came to assess it as an ephemeral stream as opposed to, say, an intermittent one.
Yeah. And that's a fair question. That I have been able to view it from the roadside.
Right.
Forget the name. I'm not familiar with the names of the roads. The pointer. Down this road, that.
Yes.
Anyway, and during all of my three broader site visits, it has been dry at the time.
Okay.
And from that as well, you can sort of get a bit of a vantage upstream and downstream to get an idea of the potential flow conditions. And factored into that was looking at sort of potential recent evidence of flows, grass lying down, debris on the sides,
right.
And whether there was terrestrial, in this case, pasture growing through the channel, or was it sort of more aquatic related species, be that sort of typical wetland species or macrophytes in their own right. And then during all site visits, it was dry, and I couldn't find any evidence of some of those typically wet orientated plants,
right,
growing through it.
Mm. Thanks for that explanation. I'm interested in that your assessment in relation to that stream, particularly in light of your initial assessment, if I understand it correctly, of the northern tributaries, which you'd also assessed without the benefit of a site visit as ephemeral, and then came to reclassify as intermittent as a result of a site visit. And I think, yes, you refer to this at paragraph 6.15 in your evidence. So I'm interested in you providing a little bit more of an elaboration there too as to the change in classification as a result of the site visit and whether there might be the possibility that you know, you could come to a similar conclusion with the benefit of a site visit in relation to that southern tributary. And also, whether your figure 3 actually reflects that change, I'm not sure that it does, but if you could just clarify that, please.
Yeah. So in my initial assessment, I hadn't been able to visit. I'd only been able to visit this sort of southern branch, I think I'd call it subcatchment A in figure 3. And I was basing the wider classification on discussions with that landowner and his recount of the stream, the flows within his property, and then conversations he had apparently had with neighbouring landowners. Since then, I have been able to visit as a result of doing the wetland surveys aspects of these streams. So I've now been able to, and this includes discussions with the relevant landowners, in situ landowners, and now visual inspection of the stream. I've reclassified this northern branch, subcatchment D, as perennial rather than okay. intermittent.
I see.
And left the others as ephemeral based on discussions. Yep. I haven't coloured green in this case, or coloured it as perennial, the downstream extent of this stream system here, but I've reasonably assumed that it would also be or should be considered perennial,
right,
based on flows received from the northern subcatchment D.
Mm. Thank you. That's really helpful. Just in terms of, are you able to point out site 9, I think it was, the Tipene property?
Yeah. We have to go back to...
is that going to be difficult?
Figure 2. Tap. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, so it is approximately this square in here.
Right. Okay, so it's right within the designation extent. Are you just able to clarify for us again how the NOR is expected to impact from an ecological point of view on that property? I'm conscious of the fact that we have submissions not just from this TPNE, but obviously from iwi submitters as well, highlighting the cultural significance of this particular area from a wetland and a stream, you know, waterways point of view in a cultural context, because it is somewhere that's regarded as important from a mahinga kai point of view. So I'd be really grateful if you could just highlight for us how that wetland system or stream system, if you like, from your perspective, will be impacted by the Inoa.
I guess in short, that will be subject to the detailed design of the site.
Understand.
It's certainly my intention that the design, as it's been detailed,
yes,
will be sensitive to that area, and opportunities will be explored for, in the first case, avoidance, but I would, based on levels and stuff, that might be quite difficult. So secondly, the replacement almost within situ, within the near vicinity, so right, it remains spatially similar. But certainly if that cannot be achieved, then there will be opportunity, and my expectation would be that habitats similar, if not better, are provided for elsewhere on site, preferably within the vicinity, but certainly connected to that stream system catchment,
mm-hmm.
and that the details of the consideration of the values that are provided for in this instance would be done in collaboration with mana whenua, if not in this case led by mana whenua, acknowledging that from a ecological perspective the values are low, so there's no particular ecological values that would need to be factored into this particular package or area or offset.
Bearing in mind, though, that, and I accept what you say from an ecological perspective, but there is an aspect of that ecological assessment that involves consideration of cultural values, which, of course, as we've heard in relation to the other assessments, hasn't been provided due to the absence of a cultural values assessment. But in the submissions of the iwi submitters and Rangitane in particular, the tributaries that will be severely modified and to a large degree destroyed through the culverting and the reclamation process that's required for the NOR. Those streams are regarded as having much higher value from a cultural perspective. So they're not characterised as sort of low-level farm drains. They are regarded as the headland waters and the lifeblood of the Mangaone stream. When those values are incorporated into an ecological assessment, how does that alter or change the conclusions that you might reach, for instance, and the ability to provide for whatever offset and compensation mitigation might be required?
So two aspects. In terms of influencing ecological assessment, I don't see I see them as still being two separate assessments, in my opinion, for good reason. Thinking about it, I can't see a reason why it would change the ecological assessment, and it might change the values that are presented, but that would be captured in the cultural assessment. And then step further in terms of mitigation, offset, that idea, I don't believe there is friction between ecological mitigation offsetting and cultural offsetting. I'm no expert in te ao Māori or anything, but my take on te mana o te wai is that concept of putting the ecosystem first is synonymous with a different worldview hat on, but is synonymous with achieving good, sound ecological outcomes, so they can work together. But in terms of the assessing the values of the site, I think it's worthwhile keeping those elements separate, and then we can start to understand who and how and what should be leading the the mitigation and or offset detail, design and components, such that the higher values are put first.
I understand your response. I just wonder though, I mean, to the when it comes to an assessment of the NPS FM and te mana o te wai, and in this case, you know, there are clearly identified values of cultural significance that have been identified in relation to these stream systems and their connection to the Mangone, and which then of course feeds into the Manawatu, over which a number of iwi have statutory authorities which are recognised in their deeds of settlement. I wonder how, in fact, what you're suggesting, you know, makes sense, because it seems to me that the national policy statement on fresh water with its emphasis on te mana o te wai is intended to be, you know, providing the guidance for the way in which ecological assessments of this kind are actually undertaken, and the values, the cultural values associated with water systems, natural waterways, are integrated into that assessment. Would you say that te mana o te wai is sufficiently provided for within the context of the NOR at this stage, recognising, of course, that there will be further detailed design later on at the consenting stage, but, you know, do you consider that there is sufficient information for us at this stage to be assured that te mana o te wai will be provided for through this proposal from an ecological perspective?
In short, yes, and that's at this stage I've been able to identify that there are no sort of highly valuable, sensitive, or unmodified habitats within the site. And then at the detailed design and regional consenting phase, the principles of the NPS and considerations of te mana o te wai will be considered. They, my understanding is, they now have to be, and I see it from an ecological perspective that this NOR provides the opportunity to at least achieve a known net loss, but through other measures and design features can enhance, and currently it's highly modified through the farming practices. So it's about, in my view, about seeking those opportunities to provide better outcome, if we take an outcomes focus, to provide some form of betterment. Not sure what they look like as yet, but thanks to the NPS, that will have to be taken into consideration.
I understand what you're saying. I guess my concern is that, you know, there's a significant amount of loss in terms of stream length and natural waterways. And with that comes a significant loss of cultural value in terms of the mana and the mauri associated with each of those stream systems. To be able to offset or compensate for that loss within the context of the designation site is a question that looms large for me. I'm very unclear as to how and whether that how that can be provided for. And I guess what I'd like to know, and this may be more a planning question actually, when I think about it, is what Kiwi Rail's proposed consenting approach would be, and what potentially viable opportunities there are for offset or compensation mitigation within or outside of the designation site. Just check my questions, make sure I've covered them all off here. Just one more quick one, and that is in relation to fish passage. You mentioned that you were pretty confident, given the gradient and size of the pipes, and that you know the fish species that you've mentioned are likely to be able to get relatively easy access through those pipes. I'm concerned more about the darkness, and as I understand it, the absence of light can be a significant deterrent for fish species, and particularly for our taonga species, in migrating their way through the culvert system. So, what are your views on that, and what mitigation is there if necessary to, you know, provide more light?
Yeah, I probably see it as, especially with culverts this length, there's two aspects to that. There is the passage aspect and the length of, in this case, darkness, but there's also the what can be contained within those culverts to not necessarily just support passage, but also support the well-being of fish within. And broadly speaking, New Zealand Indigenous fish are primarily nocturnal to start with. So darkness, in and of itself isn't necessarily an issue. Okay. It's whether there is that food source, well, there's the unimpeded passage and or the food source within those dark environments to support, be that a passage life stage or be that a resident life stage, adult life stage. And from a passage point of view, the darkness I don't see as being a deterrent to passage, or at least a consideration that needs to be given ample weighting to. And what I've tried to say in evidence in the report is that I actually see this as being an opportunity to provide fish passage, which I see as currently being unfavourable. I highlighted earlier about the annual seasonal drying out, but there's also the stock access, there's the lack of riparian vegetation and shade. And certainly when I was on site in summer, the water temperatures were quite high. And I think the low gradient that I see is helpful for being fish passage from the culvert installation point of view, means that currently there's not that sufficient flow to replenish or to cool the water temperature and replenish the oxygen, dissolved oxygen component. So currently unfavourable from a number of elements. The installation of the culvert provides an opportunity to provide passage to upstream habitats, but also provides an opportunity to actually create habitat opportunities in situ that, granted, will at this stage always be dark. There might be the opportunity to explore lighting, but I wouldn't speculate on that. But aside from that, there won't be the frequent disturbance that they're currently that currently occurs. There will be, the water temperature will be reduced, and my understanding in sort of offline conversations, at least with Mr. Leahy, is that there's also design features that can be incorporated into culverts, meanders, baffles,
right,
elements like that that
right,
can also help,
okay,
improve oxygen levels and the like. So I probably went into a lot of detail, but
that's really
helpful. I see it as, yeah, not just being a passage.
Mm. Yeah, I was trying to envisage it from a fisher's point of view, and it looked pretty dim and dark and gloomy until you described it more aptly. So thanks very much for your evidence and responses. Thank you.
It's now time for morning tea, so we'll come back and there will still be further questions. So we'll come back at 11:20.